The willow swamps, given the sandy beach in front, looked almost like the kind of mangrove swamps found along tropical beaches, at least if you ignored the ice floes. I calculated that I'd covered about 41 kilometers from where I'd reached Great Bear. Not too bad, I figured, on only 3 hours sleep. After a dinner of freeze-dried lasagna, I lay in my tent, falling asleep to the peaceful sounds of squawking shorebirds and grinding, shattering ice. By 2:30 a.m., I was awake and rolling up my sleeping bag, packing the spare clothes that formed my pillow and my other gear. I ate a couple of energy bars and took down my tent and packed it in a waterproof bag. Then I flipped the canoe over and carried it back down the beach to the water's edge, packing the two barrels, backpack, and other miscellaneous items carefully. By 3:15, I was on my way. The ice had dissipated somewhat, leaving more open water between the hundreds of floes. Under bluish-gray skies, the lake felt unnaturally calm, and with thin vapors rising over the ice where the warmer air met the colder water, it looked almost like a painting. Without wind, the temperatures had edged up somewhat, allowing a cloud of mosquitoes to buzz around me while I paddled among the floes. I weaved through them without too much trouble. The floes range in size from less than a meter across to as much as 7 or 8. In certain places, it was necessary to break up some thin or slushy ice to force a passage through. In other places, where thicker floes were in the way, I'd push off from them with my paddle to add some momentum. Once through this initial pack ice close to shore, I found that the ice ahead formed a continuous field spreading over hundreds of acres. Fortunately, though, it was mostly melted and was rather slushy as it half sank into the water. I could break a passage through it with my paddle, jabbing away at the ice, ramming into it with the bow, and then pushing on through. It was slow, but it was progress. Beyond this thin ice, the lake opened again, with bigger, more solid ice floes drifting about. They looked thick enough to stand on, though it seemed unwise to do so. To avoid more ice and round the headland that had prevented me seeing up the coast, it was necessary to paddle farther offshore. Once I'd passed the headland, I saw more ice lay ahead. For some distance, I managed to snake between it, and in some stretches avoided entirely. But after only about 5 kilometers, it became too thick to proceed. I'd arrived at a deep bay, off which a great peninsula extended diagonally out into the lake. Massed along the approaches to this peninsula were ice fields that stretched far offshore. From the stern of my canoe, I scanned for any passage through, but couldn't make any out. The ice, however, from the distance I was at, seemed weak enough that I might be able to batter a passage through it. It was a delicate matter, though, as I had to balance not wishing to puncture my canoe with the necessary brute force to clear a passage. I was also acutely aware that if I were to sink out here in frigid water, far from shore, there was a good chance hypothermia would claim me before I could reach dry land. Still, aided by my life jacket, which I always wore, I'm cautious like that, I figured I could just about manage to swim in time before my limbs seized up. Amid the pack ice, I noticed a narrow, maze-like channel. I headed for it in the canoe, but a bit of thin ice barred the way to it. As I neared the thinner ice, I spun the canoe around so that the stern, where I was seated, faced it. That way I could jab at the weak ice with my paddle, breaking open the passage. Then I spun back to edge the bow into the opening. It was slow going, as I had to constantly shift from left to right, pushing off from the ice on either side to move the canoe forward. Onward I zigzagged, deeper into the ice, sometimes breaking up the weaker sections, and other times managing to squeeze into gaps of open water between larger floes that were still as much as 6 inches or more thick. By now the wind had picked up a bit. After only a short distance, my progress was halted by a thicker patch of ice that didn't want to budge. So I reversed, paddling backward, in order to take a second run at it. Building up a little speed, I rammed the canoe at it. But rather than break it, the canoe's bow just skidded up onto the ice and stuck there. Evidently, this floe was thicker than it appeared. I tried reversing again with paddle strokes, but I couldn't dislodge the canoe. Cautiously, I sprawled forward in my canoe, over my backpack and barrels, to try to free the canoe by pushing off the ice with my paddle. Putting my weight into it, a hard push at last dislodged us. Exhaling from the effort, I cast a glance around the ice labyrinth. This one was much thicker than the ones I'd already navigated, and it seemed I wasn't going to be able to force my way through it, after all. Seagulls passed in the distance over the ice, their raspy cries ringing out across the cold waters. I decided to back out of the ice and search elsewhere along the pack edge for an opening. But since the individual floes were constantly shifting on the rising wind, while I'd been busy dealing with the ice, the wind had closed the passages behind me after I'd squeezed through them. I was trapped. My canoe was wedged between floes, unable to move forward or back or side to side. This was a bit disconcerting. Locked in the ice like this, if the wind were to shift offshore and really pick up, I'd be blown out into the heart of the lake, miles from land. As romantic as drifting for miles on ice floes may sound, it wasn't something I had any great wish to personally experience just now. To free up some space to maneuver, I tried forcing the flow on my port side away from the canoe, digging my paddle into it and pushing as hard as I could while the boat stayed braced against the ice on the other side. The flow shifted about an inch. Then I turned around in my canoe to jab at the thick ice behind me. Eventually, I managed to smash some of it off. Still, I was surrounded. So I had to work cautiously all around the boat, breaking enough ice with the paddle to be able to maneuver it again. I needed to be able to slightly adjust the canoe's position so that it would point toward a weaker bit of thin ice between some floes. That was the escape route. With hard effort, I freed the canoe enough to be able to push back through the maze in the direction I'd entered it, this time taking a different channel back. Gradually, paddling and pushing off the ice slabs, I reached the open water again with relief. Once out of the labyrinth, I tried paddling along the outer edge of the pack ice, striking at it with my paddle to test any leads. Again and again, I jabbed at the ice. It was thicker than it looked. Finally, I found a short opening between some of the floes, but it was no use. I'd never make it all the way across the ice to the open water, nearly a kilometer away. So I pushed off again and rethought my approach. It was a cloudy morning, still only about 5 a.m., with rain threatening. The rain, I hoped, might help melt the ice, making it weak enough to get through. But how long that would take was uncertain, and I knew I had to keep going. As it was, with the ice having thwarted my advance, I was in a predicament. I could think of two options rather than just giving up and waiting for the ice to melt. On the one hand, a safe option, which would be painstakingly slow and wearisome, and on the other, a riskier, dangerous one. The first, safe option, was to paddle deeper into the bay I'd been passing by, which was free of ice except near shore, and then try to break a passage through to the shoreline. If I could get close to shore, it was conceivable that I might be able to proceed along it, assuming there was a bit of open water in close, as is sometimes the case on icy lakes in springtime. Failing that, I could land on shore and continue on foot, portaging all of my gear to beyond the ice, bypassing it altogether to continue my journey. But how long that would take, I had no idea, as the ice field might extend for miles. The second, riskier option was to paddle in the opposite direction, far offshore deeper into the lake, seeking the end of the ice. In terms of width, the ice floes didn't seem much more than half a kilometer, but in length, I was rather less sure. I could see open water on the horizon, so if I paddled deep enough out into the lake, it seemed I'd be able to reach it and skirt round the pack ice. My mind toyed with which of these options to take. Should I play it safe? Would the wind pick up? How far did the ice extend? 2, maybe 3, maybe more kilometers? What if on the far side there wasn't any passage back to shore? If an offshore wind picked up while I was along the pack edge, I could be swept far out into the lake. Or if the wind blew onshore, creating waves, My canoe might be swamped or else thrown onto a floe. The cautious side of me won out. I decided to paddle into the bay toward the shore. But as I neared the floe edge inside the bay, it became apparent that the ice was considerably thicker than it had appeared from a distance. Worse, there didn't seem to be any open water near the shoreline. Seated in the stern of my canoe, it was hard to get a good view. So, cautiously, I stood up, allowing me to see better over the distance. Standing up, I could see it was as I feared. The ice extended right to the shore with no break. Any hope of finding open water along the shoreline that would allow me to continue was dashed. Worse still, even my hope of portaging beyond the ice was, I could see clearly, not possible, for in order to do that, I'd first have to get to the shore, and the ice that separated me from it was much too thick to break through with my canoe or paddle. I paddled idly, hovering around the pack edge, calculating my next move. The wind had increased a bit, but it still wasn't too bad. From what I could see, admittedly not much, the ice didn't cover all of Great Bear, just this one little corner of it, which was now tripping up all my progress. If I could just find some way around these ice fields, I'd be able to continue my journey. It seemed an awful shame to squander the relative calm spell just waiting for ice to melt. And thus, by degrees, the more adventurous side of my brain asserted itself, as if leading me by the hand toward the riskier option, paddling far offshore, deeper into the lake. How far the ice extended out into the lake was unclear, but it certainly did appear that there was an open passage out there. Perhaps, after all, it might be less than a kilometer, which I could skirt round quickly and easily, safely resuming my travels once round it close to shore, the whole thing taking less than half an hour. Surely, the wind ought to hold off for that long. I began paddling toward the middle of the lake, setting a quick pace, as I wanted to get around the ice pack as fast as I could before the wind had a chance to pick up. Hopefully, I wouldn't have to paddle the whole way around it, as there might be a thin enough patch in it where I could simply plow through it, thus reaching the open water on the far side faster, which across the pack ice looked tantalizingly close. But as I paddled along, scrutinizing the edge, I couldn't see a break in the ice open enough to make the dash through it. 10 minutes of paddling and searching had brought me more than a kilometer offshore, farther than was strictly comfortable, out here as I was on the world's 8th largest lake, alone in a canoe. But the prospect of finding an opening in just a few more strokes kept drawing me on. Only when I glanced back at the increasingly distant shoreline did my cautious side finally reassert itself. The pack ice looked to continue for another kilometer, maybe more, and I wasn't going to risk going any farther to find out, not with the wind rising. It was time to abandon any thought of skirting round the ice pack, and instead retreat to shore. I drew a long sea stroke with my blade, spinning the canoe around. Then I paddled rapidly back along the ice, shuddering a little at the thought of having been lured so far out. Luckily, at the mouth of the bay I had only partly explored was a tiny island surrounded by rocks and grown over with spruces and willows. The near side of the island was only a stone's throw from shore, whereas the other side faced out toward the vastness of the lake. From the island I'd be able to keep an eye on ice conditions. Besides, if I had to be stranded, I figured I'd rather it be on an island, like Robinson Crusoe. Chapter 8. The Ice Labyrinth. The island's shore was made up of fist-sized rocks that made landing somewhat difficult, especially now that I was more conscious than ever of the need to minimize wear and tear on the canoe. Smashing through ice had been a necessity, but I knew what ice could do to a boat, as I'd seen Titanic, twice. So I couldn't take for granted just scraping straight up onto the rocks, then climbing to the front of the canoe over my barrels. That sort of thing is well enough in cottage country, but here, sooner or later, if it put a hole in the canoe's bow, I'd be in trouble. Instead, I carefully spun the canoe parallel to the rocky shore, as close to it as the shallow water would permit. Then I stood up, slowly stretched out one leg, and set my boot down on dry land. Then, with one foot on shore and the other still in the canoe, I gently pulled the boat in close, avoiding any more scrapes than necessary. My total progress had been barely more than 5 kilometers from my last campsite. But since I'd set off so early, it was still only 8 a.m., and with any luck, I might manage to be underway again before the day was out. In the meantime, there was nothing to do but to wait, either for the ice to melt or for the wind to shift it enough to open up leads. I left my canoe resting there and went to investigate the little island. It was a charming enough place. The ground was mostly rocky and overgrown with willows and small spruces. Among the willows matted low to the ground, I noticed 4 lichen-covered rocks. The archaeologist in me noted that they were placed in an arrangement that was unlikely to have been natural. They were larger than the small cobbles strewn elsewhere across the island and formed roughly a spread-out square. In the middle of the overgrown rocks, lying beneath the matted Arctic willow, sinking into sphagnum moss, I found a few old animal bones. Evidently, someone had once landed on this island and cooked a meal here, arranging the 4 rocks to shelter the flames. The bones were clearly old. Lichens had already begun to form on them. I pulled up what seemed to be the tibiotarsus of a goose, probably a snow goose or Canada goose, both of which are common on Great Bear's sheltered bays. There was also what looked like part of a goose femur and a few other bits, but the rest of the bones had likely been chewed away by mice. Judging from the various clues, the age of the willows, the presence of lichens not only on the bones but also the stones, which would have otherwise been burned off in a fire, how the bones had become half embedded in the moss, and the absence of any visible ashes or charcoal, my best guess was that at least 40 or 50 years had elapsed since whoever had been here and had the campfire. Perhaps it had been a hunter, a fly-in sport fisher with her guide, or even a passing trapper. But in the absence of other artifacts, it was hard to know. I sprawled out comfortably beneath a spruce tree in the middle of the island and dozed off. The cool breeze kept the mosquitoes to a tolerable amount. An hour passed before I stirred to check on the conditions. The sun, which had crept out from the morning's clouds, was rapidly melting the thinner chunks of ice around the island. Farther out, though, the pack ice that had blocked my route remained very much an impassable barricade. It was shifting on the wind, edging westward, the direction from where I'd come that morning. Since it now seemed clear that I'd be waiting for some time, I decided to fetch my kettle and make myself some tea. After more than a month of continual travel, it felt like a vacation to suddenly be able to rest, enjoy a cup of tea, and relax on the island. Perhaps being stranded in ice wasn't so bad after all. I lit a match and held it to a bit of dry sedge placed inside a teepee of spruce twigs. For the first time in perhaps half a century, the silent rocks once more sheltered a blaze. As the hours drifted by, I drank tea, daydreamed, made notes in my journal, and watched waterfowl fly across the bay. There were mergansers, pintails, and goldeneyes, freshly arrived in these latitudes from their migration north. Just off the southern tip of the island was a large ice floe, still thick with several big blocks of ice heaped up onto it by the wind. A flock of pintails landed on it, making me think of penguins drifting on an ice floe. Gulls of various kinds, too, soared above the bay's open water, hunting for fish. It'd been about a week since I'd last washed my face, so making the most of my island stay, I dipped my face into the ice-cold water along the shore. One thing I didn't do much, resting under the spruce and staring off at the drifting ice, was wonder about what was going on in the world at large. The news, I figured, never much changed, and I found I didn't mind not knowing what was up with the world. As the morning and afternoon passed, the pack ice shifted rapidly, the wind blowing it farther west, but more ice came along with it, keeping the route blocked. I was still hoping to push on that day should any break in the ice materialize. With that in mind, I cooked up a freeze-dried meal, consuming the calories in the hopes that it would give me the energy needed to make a hard push that night along the lake. But as the hours slowly ticked away, the offshore ice to all appearances remained impenetrable. If anything, the evening had seen more ice drift into view. I'd assumed from what little I'd seen that the lake had largely melted, but the steadily drifting ice suggested that farther east, much of the lake must still be frozen. Trouble was, without a bird's eye view, how much or how little of Great Bear's immense 31,153 square kilometers was open water or ice, I had no real idea. From what I'd seen in the Yukon, it had been shaping up to be a later ice melt than the previous year. By late evening, I'd resigned myself to the fact that for the time being, I wasn't making it any farther through the ice. I set up my tent on the island in the only place there was room for it, squeezed between some willow bushes and a spruce. Then I lay down to sleep, hoping that when I woke, the wind would have shifted the ice enough to resume paddling. Around midnight, I stirred from my sleep. It was cold enough that I could see my breath inside the tent. I crawled out of the warmth of my sleeping bag and unzipped the tent's door. It was still light out, but the skies were clouded over, giving a twilight kind of gloom to things. I pushed through the willows to get a look at the lake, to find out what the ice had done since I'd been asleep. I was hoping that the wind would have blown it clear away, leaving me with open waters. Instead, I could barely believe what I saw. The ice had multiplied. Now the whole bay was iced over. The floes had drifted in all around the island, stretching off in all directions, entombing me on this little speck in the vast lake. I shook my head in surprise, but took heart in the speed with which the pack ice was plainly shifting on the winds. A few hours more and it might yet open a passage for me. I thus climbed back inside my tent to sleep some more, hoping for better prospects the next time I woke. Not quite 3 hours later, around 3 a.m., my eyes opened as I rolled over on a spruce root, which ran under the tent. I crawled out of my sleeping bag and back outside to find out what fate had in store for me now. Pushing through the willows, I was surprised to see nothing at all. Thick fog had swallowed up the island, making it difficult to see much of anything. Nevertheless, my hopes rose a little, as I knew fog must mean warmer air temperatures were melting the ice. I scampered down to the south end of the island, pushing past willows out onto the rocks for a better view. There was some open water here, extending out a considerable way, at least before the mist obscured things. I couldn't be sure, but it looked fairly encouraging. At any rate, a full day idle on the island had made me restless to push on, as what had initially seemed charming had now begun to feel more like an icy prison. Anxious that the fast-shifting ice floes would close up the passage before I could escape, I raced to take down my tent, pack things up, and reload my canoe. By 3:30 a.m., I'd launched the canoe and was paddling away from the island back out into the lake. The fog limited visibility, but straight off from the island was a wide passage that was easy enough to make out. It brought me back in the general vicinity of where I'd tried previously to break across the ice. Pack ice still cloaked the lake as far as I could see eastward. An eerie, dead calm reigned, which at least would make things easier than they'd been the day before, when the wind shifted the floes on me after I'd entered into them. The ice had definitely thinned from what had been 24 hours earlier. I found a lead between two floes and began to weave into the pack. The core of the ice slabs, normally about the size of a big kitchen table, was still solid and opaque with white ice, but the edges had dissipated into clear ice that could be smashed and broken up. My canoe's bow broke through this thin ice as I proceeded along, while I smashed with my paddle any other ice. In certain places, I'd have to put a little more muscle into it to split in two some of the larger floes that stood in the way. This took repeated jabs, aided by putting weight on the ice to force it down into the water. The water then flooding onto the ice helped break it up. But, in spite of my best efforts, it was soon apparent that the ice was still too thick to get through. I sighed, alarmed at the thought that for the second day in a row I might be stranded in the ice, my daily distance amounting to almost nothing. The odds of me finishing my journey before the onset of winter were dwindling. Up until now, I'd been ahead of schedule, but Great Bear's late ice breakup was a bad hand to be dealt. Even if I could get through the ice, wind and waves might still pin me down on the lake's north shore. With a sinking feeling in my heart, I pictured the sands of time in an hourglass remorselessly running out. Winter on the horizon. The thought of turning back to exile on the little island, failing to advance any farther, was a disheartening prospect. Instead, I resolved to at least force my way through the ice to the mainland across the bay, which I'd tried yesterday without success. That way, I'd at least be able to console myself with having inched a tiny bit closer to my end goal, rather than accomplishing nothing at all. On the mainland, I could also hike ahead on foot to scout out the ice conditions. Thus, I pushed through the ice, shoving with my paddle the bigger floes away from the canoe and struggling slowly to get through the pack. An hour later and I'd come to the bay's shore. It didn't appear at all inviting, with dense alder bushes 6 feet high cloaking the coastline. Rocks extending off the shore into the shallows, combined with the ice, made landing difficult. I couldn't parallel park next to the shore as I normally did, so instead I had to crawl carefully over my gear up to the bow and climb out that way. Once on dry land, I crouched down to squeeze through the alders toward more open terrain inland. Here, away from shore, the ground rose up a small hill, thinly treed with spruces and some tamaracks, and carpeted with thick green sphagnum moss, blueberries, lingonberries, and lichens, although it'd be another 5 or 6 weeks before any berries ripened. On the bright side, there was ample wood for making fires, but on the downside it was much buggier, with swarms of mosquitoes that materialized as if summoned by black magic at my appearance. I slogged my stuff through the alders, including my canoe, which was too dear a friend to leave all alone down by the shore. I always brought it with me to my camps, flipping it over near my tent if there was room for it. We'd sometimes have conversations about such things as which route to take, how the weather looked, the ice, and where to camp. I tended to do most of the talking, but the canoe was a great listener, very seldom interrupting. Since it was still early morning, I set up my tent and went back to sleep for a few hours. Thwarted as I was by the ice, I intended to make the most of it by sleeping and resting as much as I could. That way, when the ice finally did shift or melt, I'd be prepared to put in extra long days of hard paddling to make up for lost time. Light rain fell off and on during the day, while I occasionally crawled through the alders to stare pensively at the unmoving ice. Thick mist made seeing much of anything difficult, but again I consoled myself with the thought that the mist was vapor rising from the ice. Little by little, it must be melting. Later I scouted north along the peninsula, to get a better idea of how much water ahead was still frozen. The thick sphagnum moss, which I sank into as I walked, coupled with the uneven ground and mosquitoes, made hiking difficult. But I was hopeful that I might discover that open water lay just ahead. Alas, I saw only more ice, miles upon miles of it, stretching off to a misty horizon. After this disheartening exploration, I returned to my campsite, wondering how many more days I'd lose before being able to escape the ice. I decided to count my rations. I figured it might be a good idea to get a handle on how long they'd last. It turned out that there was enough for another 4 weeks, which might be made to last longer with some fresh fish. After that, I'd need to arrange for a resupply with my satellite phone. That evening, when I crept back down to the lakeshore through the alders to fetch some water for tea, I marveled with surprise at a beautiful rainbow that had formed across the ice-covered lake, its bright colors standing out against dark gray skies. The rainbow disappeared into the mists rising above the ice in the distance. The floes, meanwhile, were a mix of snowy ice interspersed with pools of water, creating a dreamlike landscape. The rainbow I took as a good sign. Hours later, as I lay in my sleeping bag with my head resting on my spare clothes pillow, my ears detected a change. There was still the familiar drone of hundreds of mosquitoes trapped under my tent fly, but something else sounded different. I thought I could hear the faint sound of lapping water. Immediately, I sat up in my sleeping bag with excitement. If I could hear lapping water, it must mean that the ice had shifted or melted. Quickly, I dashed out of my bag, tossed on my jacket and bug net, and went to investigate. Pressing through the green alders, I could barely believe my eyes. Open water, and lots of it. The ice had mostly all melted. Just the odd piece floated about. I glanced at my watch. 2:35 a.m. Time I was on my way. It took 40 minutes to pack up camp and portage the loads one at a time through the thick alders to the rocky shore, where I carefully loaded the canoe. I needed to pack it just right, as I wanted to be optimistic that I wouldn't be coming back to shore for a good while. By 3:30 a.m., I was at last on my way, paddling once more out onto the vast, clear waters of Great Bear Lake. It felt wonderful to be back on the water, paddling hard. The skies remained cloudy, but my spirits soared. With open water on all sides, the closed-in, claustrophobic feel of the pack ice was gone, and I now had the thrill of wide-open vistas once more. I paddled on, passing mile upon mile of wild, beautiful tundra where the permafrost prevents trees from taking root. Elsewhere, the landscape varied with stupendous cliffs, green hills, and rocky shores. It was the kind of scene that always refreshed my spirits. The lake itself was remarkably clear and free of aquatic vegetation. Looking down into those cold, clear waters was like looking into another world. The frigid, oxygen-rich water prevents underwater weeds from growing. The result is a lake that looks deceptively empty, with sand bottoms that in places have great, silent jumbles of boulders and rocks resembling a kind of sunken moonscape. After hours of paddling without any sign of life below the placid waters, suddenly I was startled by a glimpse of an enormous creature. It jerked violently, then dove off into the depths as I passed by in my canoe. So abrupt had it appeared, and so unbelievably massive it looked in the vast clear waters, that it felt as if I'd just seen a shark. In fact, it was only a lake trout, the one weighing perhaps 70 pounds or more. Above water, especially when I came across sheltered bays, birds were plentiful. I saw pintails, loons, mergansers, Canada geese, bald eagles, Arctic terns, and sandpipers. I suspected that as temperatures warmed, I'd see even more kinds. At the close of each day, stretched out in my snug little tent, I'd tally up the birds and other wildlife I'd seen during the day, and it was always a thrill to add a new species that I hadn't seen before. Birds and fish weren't the only things about. Paddling silently along, my eyes spotted a herd of 5 shaggy, horned musk ox wandering the coast, looking like creatures from another time. A couple of them swam in the icy water, something I'd never seen before. Their thick fur, however, is reputed to be the warmest in the world, which I could appreciate from personal experience. Some years earlier, while canoeing in the high Arctic, I found my jackets and clothing totally inadequate for the biting cold of the fierce Arctic winds. It seemed to cut right through my 3 layers to the bone. Scattered all over the Arctic tundra in easily collected quantities where I was camping was musk ox fur, which they shed in summertime. So I gathered up handfuls of it and stuffed it down my jacket and pants like a scarecrow, and never again on that journey did I suffer from the cold. Paddling on, hour after hour, in places I encountered more pack ice, but I weaved through it without much trouble, as the leads between the floes had become larger. There were also more large icebergs, looking magical as they drifted in the clear water. I paddled by them, marveling at the beauty. One was nearly 40 feet long. Out on the lake, there weren't any bugs once I was paddling, as the wind blew them away. I finally stopped after 14 and a half hours travel, during which time I never once touched shore. When I needed to stretch, I'd simply stand up in the canoe, while my lunch, as usual, was energy bars. The extra rest had paid off. I'd managed to cover approximately 67 and a half kilometers, or an average of just under 5 kilometers an hour. To cap off such a physically exhausting but rewarding day, I camped on a beautiful tundra site amid pink and white wildflowers. Looking out across the lake, I could see far out in the center that large amounts of ice still remained. I hoped it would stay where it was, either melting away out there, or if it was to shift, that the wind would carry it to the far shore, and not the one I was paddling. Living outdoors, you get to appreciate nature in all its moods. The morning after my long paddle, the day dawned cold, wet, gray, and dismal. I got out my balaclava and my warmer pair of waterproof gloves. I was back to three layers, the wool blend base layer, then khaki pants and wool sweater, and finally my outer rain pants with the warmer of my two jackets. Fog and stiff headwinds slowed my progress, and I soon came across more ice. Fortunately, I was able to navigate the ice without too much delay, though there was still some ice breaking required to get through it. By midday, the skies had mostly cleared, but the wind remained unfavorable. I put my back into it, paddling as steadily as I could. To save the time it would take to snake down into a deep bay, I did chance one largest open water crossing. It wasn't by normal standards much of a big crossing, merely 1.3 kilometers in a straight line from shore to shore. In more temperate places or with a canoeing partner, I'd often ventured far greater distances from shore. But things were different alone in the Arctic, where I could still see sheets of ice drifting. Remote as the prospect seemed, I had to consider what might happen if, in the middle of a big water crossing, I suddenly suffered some freak muscle spasm or cramp, leaving me at the mercy of the wind. Sometimes, though, you just have to play the odds. By July, I figured the last of the ice had almost all melted, and I'd have open water from here on out across Great Bear. The first of the month, Canada Day, I crawled out of my tent before 7 a.m. and was pleased to see clear skies and calm waters. That morning, I passed a long, sandy white beach, where a lone grizzly was quietly wandering among the dunes. The beautiful beach extended for over 6 kilometers, and I thought it would be a wonderful place to rest, but I knew I couldn't afford to stop when the wind was still down. So I kept paddling, snacking on some high-calorie energy bars to keep me going. Rounding the beach and continuing along the shore, I was surprised to see the sun glinting off vast fields of ice. It hadn't all melted after all. This ice pack extended from the north shore out into the lake at least several kilometers, and it stretched as far as I could see along the coast ahead of me. In the midst of this giant ice field was one iceberg that rose up high out of the water, towering over the rest like a snow fort. But surely, given it was July, I figured I could push through this ice. Paddling, however, soon proved ineffective. The ice pack was too thick. Trying to force my way through it was exhausting work. To advance just a few hundred meters involved continuously smashing and breaking up the thinner ice with my paddle, combined with pushing the bigger floes far enough away from the canoe to squeeze between them. An hour's effort had seen me advance only a kilometer into the ice. Clearly, I needed a different approach. So I tried poling through the ice, as I still had my trusty beaver pole that I'd found along the Mackenzie. Standing up in the canoe, I grasped the pole and used it to push off the floes, propelling my canoe along over thinner ice. The ice crunched and shattered as I moved along, breaking a channel as I went. Canoes are perhaps not intended to be used as icebreakers, but mine I found quite effective at it. However, it soon became too thick to push through. And at the rate I was going, I was exhausting myself with little to show for it. I began to wonder, given that the shoreline here was not choked with willows and alders like earlier on, whether it might actually be faster to just portage along the shore. The shoreline was a mix of tundra plants, sand, and pebble beaches. Maybe, just maybe, I thought that wheeled cart sitting in the front of my canoe might at last come in use. I forced the boat through the ice to shore, alternatively zigzagging through the icy labyrinth or else breaking a passage when there was none. I pushed and prodded my way across the ice, occasionally causing floes to sink beneath the canoe until I reached the shore. The underside of my canoe was looking rather scratched up, with some deeper gouges that somewhat unsettled me, but no fatal punctures, so far. Leaving the rest of my gear on the beach to pick up later, I strapped the canoe onto the cart, which consisted of two hard plastic wheels specifically designed for rough usage. Then, I began dragging the cart, weaving between juniper bushes, willows, and rocks. It sort of worked, for a little ways, but overall, the cart wasn't much of an improvement over simply dragging the canoe over the ground or carrying it over my head. The terrain was too cluttered with obstacles for it to work effectively. So after half a kilometer of this, I stopped on a stony beach surrounded by treeless tundra. I hadn't even come close to bypassing the ice fields, and I concluded that it was simply not worth the energy and calories expended to push on with portaging. My time was better spent resting, waiting for the ice to melt or shift. Over a driftwood fire, I boiled water for a freeze-dried dinner while gazing out on the ice fields that had foiled my progress, wondering when they'd dissipate. Things seemed encouraging when that night, lying in my tent, I watched through the screen door as the ice began to smash up and shift, partly breaking off waves that were rolling in. I was hopeful that I'd have clear waters come morning. The dawn, well, not exactly dawn, since the sun only briefly sank below the horizon, just dipping down and up again, brought the clear water I'd hoped for. But it also brought stiff opposing winds that promised to test every ounce of my mettle. I gave it my all, paddling for nearly 13 hours and battling for every inch. The winds were relentless now, as I'd reached the middle section of Great Bear, leaving behind the narrower Smith Arm. Here the lake opened up to impossible horizons, with hundreds of kilometers of open water for the wind to gather its full force over. I made sure to stay near the shore, normally not straying anything more than a half kilometer out from it. This was harder at times than it might seem, given strong winds were often blowing offshore, meaning I had to counteract them with paddling. Otherwise, I'd find myself drifting far off into the lake. There was one place, however, where I debated whether to risk paddling far offshore. I'd arrived at the entrance to a huge bay shaped like an immense paint splatter, with wide inlets extending in different directions. I knew if I could just cut across the mouth of the bay, rather than trace out the shoreline all through its odd shape, it saved me hours of paddling. But it was a gamble. The mouth was over 3 kilometers wide, a long way in a little canoe alone on an Arctic lake. In calm weather, I might have chanced it. But with the wind gusting as strong as it was, and with the icy cold waters all around me, my head said, "Don't risk it." So instead, I rounded the rocky shoreline and turned into the bay, resigning myself to tracing it out and adding considerable distance to my route as a result. The arithmetic was not at all encouraging. Instead of a 3-kilometer paddle across the bay's mouth, tracing out all of its coastline, except for a narrow bit I was sure I could skip across, it would total over 29 kilometers, which would take at least 5 hours of hard paddling. With math like that, I was almost desperate to trim off some of the shoreline with whatever crossing I could manage. Fortunately, just around the rocky peninsula leading into the bay, a bottleneck was formed between the peninsula's protruding rocky shore and the northern coastline. The distance between the two points was less than 700 meters, and if I could zip across it, I'd saw off a good 10 kilometers from the detour. The wind was raging, with big waves rolling across the channel, but I was primed for the challenge, given what was at stake. I'd been using my bent shaft paddle for the extra power, but to safely navigate the waves, I needed my straight paddle. Taking up my well-loved traditional paddle, I kneeled down in the canoe and swung the blade deep into the waves, gunning hard for the far shore. The wind was coming straight at me, a perfect headwind. I swung my paddle hard and hard again, fighting the gusting wind with every stroke. The canoe surged up and down on the waves, the bow rising clear in the air on the breaks. It was rough going. I battled my share of big waves before, but never was so heavy a load in the canoe, and my energy was already drained from the long days of paddling I'd been putting in. Determined as I was, not 5 minutes in, I knew I was beaten. I couldn't overcome the howling gusts. It was time to retreat. I waited for a break between waves to safely pivot. Then I swung the canoe back in the direction of the near shore. There was nothing for it. I'd have to take the long way round, tracing out nearly the whole bay, unless I could pull off a crossing somewhere else. There's always a silver lining, though. Being forced to take the long way around meant I'd get to see more, and I loved exploring landscapes, especially ones hidden away in the wildest bays. I soaked in the majesty of the place, admiring its endless variety. The hardy tamaracks and spruces, the wiry willows, the ancient rocks heaped and jumbled by glaciers, the clear waters, the different birds, the hidden wildlife. It was a feast for the imagination, the kind of thing I found endlessly fascinating. The natural world is so full of mystery that there's always more to see. On the other hand, once I reached the bay's inner shore, having taken the long way around to avoid the worst of the wind, my eyes looked longingly across the expanse of open water toward the bay's outlet. It occurred to me that if I were to cut straight across here, making a beeline for the far shore, I'd still be able to save a considerable amount of time and distance by avoiding the northeastern section of the bay. I calculated the distances. If I continued to remain near shore, tracing out the whole bay, there was still another 13 kilometers to get through. But if I paddled straight across, it was only 3.2 kilometers to the far shore, a significant savings on an expedition where every kilometer counted. The wind had held steady, blowing hard to the southeast. When I'd first come upon the bay, the southeast wind meant it was hitting my canoe broadside, the worst place for waves to hit. If I'd attempted the 3 kilometer crossing at the bay's opening, the wind's full force would have been hitting me broadside and pushing me out into the center of Great Bear's icy expanse. But when I turned into the bay and attempted to beeline across it to the south shore, that meant the wind was hitting me head on, driving me back where I'd come with every gust. Now, having traced the bay to its inner shore, if I were to chance this open water crossing southward, I'd have the wind behind me for the first time, giving me a powerful tailwind. Yet, tailwinds can still be risky in a little open canoe. If the waves are too big, they can spill into the canoe and sink it. The winds were fierce, but I paddled larger waves before, though perhaps not in such an isolated place all alone. Though canoeing is not normally associated with Great Bear, given that it's ice-covered for nearly 9 months out of the year and too northerly for birch trees big enough for traditional canoe making, I knew of at least 5 people who drowned canoeing on it. There were the 2 geologists who drowned in 1960 while canoeing along Great Bear's north shore. Earlier, back in the 1930s, a young trapper by the name of Abe Van Bibber had perished when his canoe overturned in the lake's icy waters. And more recently, in 1987, 2 men on a fishing trip had drowned when their canoe overturned in big waves. Once again, I got down on my knees in the canoe. It helps concentrate the weight lower and makes the canoe more stable. If I paddled fast, I might just make it across the more than 3 kilometer span before the wind had a chance to shift or pick up. Once committed, there could be no turning back, since that would mean opposing a headwind. One last glance at the thin gray outline of the distant shore, and my mind was made up. I gathered up my courage and went for it. I started paddling quickly, but cautiously. I had to navigate the waves just right. Halfway across, 1.5 kilometers from either shore, the waves seemed much larger. My canoe rose and fell with each swell. I knew the importance of remaining calm, but it was a white-knuckle affair to see land so far on all sides. Up the canoe rode on the waves, then down again as they passed along. At last, 20 minutes of hard paddling later, I reached the far shore. Dry land never felt so good. I beached my canoe to rejoice, having saved much time and energy that would have been expended in tracing out the whole bay. I celebrated with a power bar. My transit of the bay had taken 3.5 hours, after which I was once more back out on the waters of Great Bear Lake proper. I pushed on for another 13 kilometers, bringing my total distance for the day to 50 kilometers. Feeling exhausted, I used my last reserves of energy to haul my canoe up over the rocks to the tundra. There I made camp, setting up my tent, building a driftwood fire, and boiling water to cook a meal. As I did so, I was surprised to see in the distance moving ice floes, smashing and crashing into each other on the strong wind, and floating down the coastline. It was an ice pack the size of several soccer fields, rushing along on the wind and drifting right by my little camp. Sitting there on the tundra, it was the oddest feeling witnessing this ice procession moving rapidly along, floe after floe, as if it were an ice parade with me as the sole spectator. A half hour later, the parade had passed by, with just a few stragglers, ice slabs the size of kitchen tables, still drifting off after the rest of the pack. I crawled into my tent and fell into an exhausted sleep. Chapter 9. Ghosts of the Past. July brought warmer temperatures, the last of the ice, and fierce winds and storms. Severe winds along the middle section of Great Bear's North Shore, where the whole mighty expanse of the lake was facing me, required switching to more nocturnal habits. During the rough winds of the day, I'd sleep. At night, when the winds had died, I'd paddle under the glow of the midnight sun with everything I had. Bolts of lightning across the dark water brought me to a halt in the early evening on July 3rd. A storm was gathering strength in the distance, and it seemed the wind would be bringing it in my direction. I raced to make camp in time, setting up my tent in a low, sandy area back a ways from the water that seemed the safest bet for a thunderstorm. Fortunately, the storm remained distant, and I listened to it thundering across the lake while warm and dry inside my tent. I slept only a few hours on that lonely beach. By midnight, I was on my way again, paddling hard into a thick fog. Following along the wild, rocky shoreline meant taking numerous detours into bays, one of which proved so surprisingly shallow that I actually switched from my paddle to my pole and ended up poling right across it. This swampy bay stood in sharp contrast to the almost unfathomable cold depths of the lake proper. In its sheltered reaches, I saw pike, flocks of ducks and geese, and even a great bull moose swimming across the water. It was the first moose I'd seen north of the Arctic Circle, since the ones I'd encountered along the Hare Indian River were just short of that latitude. Except for one particularly frightful day of wind that kept me on shore for much of it, my daily average distance ranged from 50 to 55 kilometers. This was better progress than I had anticipated making, and I'd managed to make up for time lost in the ice. This was good news in more ways than one. The sands of the hourglass before the inclement weather of late summer weren't looking as discouraging anymore. Of more immediate concern, it meant that I could increase my daily rations. Pretty much from day one of my journey, I'd been hungry. The recommended daily calorie intake for an adult male is 2,500 calories. I'd been consuming more than 3,000 calories a day. That still left me ravenously hungry, and I certainly would have consumed more had it been possible, but there's a limit to how much you can cram into a canoe. And the more I packed, the more I'd have to lug through the trackless swamps, as well as the more dead weight to slow me down when pulling up rivers or battling winds. However, my better-than-expected progress had yielded me a surplus of food, and I'd now happily increased my allotted daily rations to 10 energy/builder/granola bars, a pack of nuts of various kinds, some dried fruit, a bit of low-sodium jerky, some of it goose jerky, a gracious gift from a friend I'd known since grade 4, and 2 freeze-dried meals to be eaten when I stopped for the day. That put my calorie intake at closer to 4,000, enough to keep me going hard all day at distances of up to 70 kilometers, but I was still losing weight, as is virtually inevitable on a journey of this nature. On the bright side, I figured that as I grew steadily thinner, I'd be less appealing to bears, who probably wouldn't find my skeletal figure very appetizing. At least I hope so. After a stretch of about 100 kilometers of rather uninviting shoreline dominated by low-lying willow swamps, the character of Great Bear's landscape changed. I'd entered into the part of the lake known as the Dease Arm, another of its 5 great arms. As I advanced up the north coast here, I found the willow swamps and tundra gave way to dramatic cliffs. I passed 2 incredible waterfalls tumbling over cliffs that seemed like something out of an ancient legend. In other places, there were pinkish granite rocks with a mix of open tundra and clusters of spruce that looked like a group of 7 painting come to life. Well, aside from the thick clouds of bugs, which don't seem to have made it into any of the group's paintings. These changed landscapes were a telltale sign I'd reached the Canadian Shield, that gigantic geologic zone covering almost half of Canada's landmass, some 8 million square kilometers, if one includes parts outside Canada. The Shield, perhaps the country's most famous landscape, stretches as far south as Muskoka, all the way north to the shores of Ellesmere Island, and east to Labrador. Its western extent is roughly Great Bear Lake itself, right where I'd now arrived. The rocky uplands and millions of lakes within the Shield make it ideal canoeing territory, at least in its more southern reaches. My last days crossing Great Bear were filled with wildlife. A lone wolf wandered along a marshy section of shoreline as I passed by. When the wolf spotted me, she just sat down and stared at me, tilting her head to the side in curiosity as I drifted past in my canoe, staring right back with equal wonder. After a good while, she rose and ran off from shore, pausing twice to look back at me, filling me with awe. In the wild, wolves have an average lifespan of about 7 years, which means some Arctic wolves will likely never encounter humans. This seems to partly explain the differences in how wolves in isolated areas behave compared with ones closer to human settlements. The former react with curiosity, the latter, having learned to fear humans, flee. Wolves weren't the only carnivores about. At the other end of the size scale, I spotted a lithe little weasel scurrying along a great slab of granite like a character out of a cartoon. Weasels are striking, tough little animals, often taking down prey as much as 10 times their own size, principally rodents and birds, but sometimes even hares. Pound for pound, they may just be the toughest carnivores on the planet, exceeding even wolverines in their ability to kill prey larger than themselves. They kill with a bite to the base of their prey's skull. In the Arctic, there are short-tailed weasels and their smaller cousins, lice weasels, both of which are hardy and adaptable enough to survive the harsh conditions. In winter, their coats are all white to camouflage with the snows, but in summer they change to brown on their heads and backs. Soon after spotting the weasel, paddling on calm waters, I came across an odd little sight bobbing up and down on the lake, a portly brown lemming swimming valiantly but largely ineffectively. It seemed so slow and helpless as to be almost cartoon-like in its frantic paddling. I wondered what it was doing so far from land, and if perhaps a hawk had dropped it from its talons while flying over the lake. On the other hand, lemmings are known to make great migrations, including even the crossing of large water. Not always successfully, they sometimes drown. Their populations follow cyclical fluctuations every few years, much like other Arctic prey species, notably hares, which trigger famines among apex predators, including wolves, lynx, and at one time, humans. Birds were plentiful in the eastern waters of Great Bear. I saw hawks, jaegers, gulls, terns, loons, ducks, geese, and bald eagles. One Arctic tern dive-bombed a raucous gull in an impressive display of aerobatic maneuvers. The terns are elegant flyers with long, sharp beaks, which they don't hesitate to use on any bird, animal, or person getting too close to one of their nests. Gulls will steal and eat other birds' eggs, if given the chance. Once I had reached the eastern shores of Great Bear Lake, I began working my way southward to seek the mouth of a river draining in from the east. This river, known as the Dease, formed the next link in the hypothetical chain I devised to take me across Canada's Arctic. Along this rocky eastern shore were many deeply indented bays several kilometers in width, but I was able to cut across most of them without much trouble, saving me from tracing them out. One of these big open water crossings surprised me by the unusual landscape on the opposite shore I was heading toward. It looked nothing like anything I'd yet seen on my journey. Rolling hills of open tundra, dotted with clusters of spruces and framed by dramatic red cliffs. The whole scene reminded me of Prince Edward Island, the Canadian Arctic astonishing me again with its amazing diversity of landscape. The stereotypical view of the Arctic, some might even say all of Canada, is a place of ice and snow and not much else. During winter, that may be so, but when the snows melt during the brief summers, a delightful complexity is revealed. On the afternoon of July 7th, tracing Great Bear's eastern shores southward, I passed into a channel formed by the mainland in the lee side of an immense island over 15 kilometers long. It was somewhere up this channel that nearly two centuries ago, in 1836, the fur traders Peter Warren Dease and Thomas Simpson and their companions had built a fort to endure the harsh winters after a long boat journey north from more southern trade posts. Their orders from the Hudson's Bay Company were to chart the unknown coastline of the Arctic Ocean. Dease had selected a crack team of Dene hunters, Canadian voyageurs, and Scottish sailors and craftsmen for the mission. They built their isolated post, Fort Confidence, here on Great Bear's north shore to serve as a base of operations while they pushed on in summer to map the Arctic coast, hoping to solve the riddle of the Northwest Passage. The older Dease's competence and careful planning, long years of experience in the fur trade, and ability to speak four languages, combined with the younger Simpson's physical prowess and daring, made for a potent combination. Dease, Simpson, and their party spent nearly 3 years here, departing in 1839. As for Fort Confidence, over the next century it gradually fell into ruin and was forgotten. Despite the importance of pushing on, I couldn't resist the temptation to pause to search for the remnants of Fort Confidence. Knowing it was somewhere on the northeastern shore, I paddled closer in to keep an eye out for any clues to its whereabouts. There wasn't much to go on, as the shore was screened from view by tall black spruces, willows, and alders, despite being north of the Arctic Circle. It was precisely the presence of that forest that had attracted the explorers to build Fort Confidence here, as they needed timber for construction and huge quantities of firewood to survive the long winters. However, I noticed a slight hill where there seemed to be a bit of a clearing, and though nearly two centuries had passed, I figured some scant glade might remain. I also figured the hill would be a logical choice for the establishment of a fort, offering a view of the lake. There was nowhere to land along the bank, as it was a bit steep and thickly grown over with alders and willows. So, instead, with a rope, I tied my canoe to a spruce tree, promising the canoe not to worry and that I'd be back soon. Then, taking a paddle as a walking stick, I climbed ashore through the thick alder bushes. Once through the alders, the ground sloped uphill, which was mostly open, grassy land. I scanned around, but couldn't see any artifacts or ruins. So I went a bit farther, rounding a thick cluster of spruces and pushing through some tall willow bushes to see if anything lay hidden behind them. Then, my eyes caught sight of something odd poking up through the thicket of willows and spruces ahead, the ghostly ruins of two stone chimneys. It was Fort Confidence, or rather what was left of it. I pushed through the willows to take a closer look. All that was left of the fort, it seemed, was the masonry associated with the chimneys and their stone and clay hearths. The buildings themselves had long since burned down, with the spruces and willows swallowing up the site over the ages. The chimneys were made of rocks pulled up from the lakeshore, the hearths neatly shaped in half moons to reflect the heat out, a vital concern in the long, dark, bone-chilling winters. One of the chimneys had toppled over, but the other was still intact and standing upright. I bent down in the hearth, inspecting it, then lay down on my back and gazed up through the chimney at the clouds passing overhead. Deason Simpson proved a remarkably effective exploring duel, far more competent than their more famous contemporary, Sir John Franklin. Deese was a native-born Canadian who traveled extensively across the country as a fur trader before coming north. He was universally liked and respected, but was noted as being not overly ambitious, and at 50 years of age, inclined not to push things too hard. Simpson couldn't have been more different. He was 20 years younger, a brash, impetuous Scottish Highlander. But they worked well together, and with their expert Dene hunters, Canadian woodsmen, and Scottish carpenters and sailors, they'd mapped huge stretches of the Northwest Passage in small boats without any loss of life from starvation, accidents, or the elements. More than can be said for Franklin with his vastly larger naval expeditions. However, things later took a decidedly strange turn for Deason Simpson. Maybe it was the winters spent isolated in their three log dwellings that were rather grandly called Fort Confidence. Certainly they didn't